Hey, this is LGBTQ&A. I'm Jeffrey Masters, and this is a show where we get to know different members of the LGBTQ community. Today, I'm talking with Jennifer Finney Boyland. She is the author of 15 books and also serves as the co-chair at GLAAD on the board. Stay tuned. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, I'm excited to chat.
Oh, good. Well, I'm excited to be chatted at. Let's make it happen.
Okay, I'll chat at you now. No, I was thinking about She's Not There, which was one of your first books, but it was the biggest one to put you on the map. Is that right?
Put me on the map.
Put you on the map.
I was lost before that.
And here you are now.
Still lost.
What was that path? No, I'm just kidding. I was thinking about that came out in 2003.
Yeah, 03.
So much has changed since then. I mean, we still have a lot of work to do, but I imagine that as like short as that time ago, you were still defining what transgender meant to people.
Yeah, a big thing that happened with that book was and also in my experience leading up to the time when I was writing the book, is that when I came out as trans, I really had to kind of explain to people what I was talking about. And I remember people saying, so wait, transgender, does that mean you're like super gay? Which I used to, you know, I get all cross and angry and like, no, no, no. But now I'm like, yes, I am super gay. That's it. It's like my, you know, I have superpowers. So, I did feel this compulsion or this obligation, I should say, to explain, to bring in, and to some degree to defend. And so that was 15 years ago. And now my experience is very different. When I speak to people, often they are already familiar with transgender issues. Even the most kind of uninformed audience still has a vague sense of what transgender might mean. And sometimes I go to places where people are quite sophisticated, and so it can be a challenge actually when I speak to different audiences. If I have both a group of 70-year-old people and a group of 15-year-olds or 20-year-olds in the audience, it's hard to know where exactly to pitch it because I don't want to lose people, but I also don't want to leave people behind either.
Yeah. So when you're talking to a group like that, where do you pitch it? Do you just like shoot for the older people?
Well, I try to get people onto the highest critical ground as quickly as possible. I will say that kind of straight up transgender 101, I don't do quite so much anymore. In a way, because we don't need it, at least in the same way, and also because, here's the challenge. I mean, transgender 101, meaning describing the different ways there are of being trans, or the different things that we are talking about when we talk about trans identities, which is actually a pretty wide family of issues with when people are dealing with gender. So it used to be that I would very carefully parse the difference between transsexuality, to use a word which we don't actually even use so much anymore, but transsexuality, cross-dressing, drag, genderqueer, gender non-conforming. I would walk people through all those identities and explain how they're different from each other. And there's still, I believe, some value in people understanding the differences between those things because, you know, people are traveling on their journeys, following the light of different stars. So it's, I think, to some degree, it can be helpful if you want to know someone, if you want to know where they're going. But when I speak to people now, in some ways, I mean, I want people to know as much as they can about the community. But the most important thing they need to know is maybe not the differences between all of us, but the fact that the main thing you can do is open your heart. Just open your heart. And if you don't know the difference between someone who's identifying as a cross-dresser and someone who's identifying as a transsexual woman, if you don't know the difference between those two things, that's still okay. What matters more is that you approach them with love and with kindness and curiosity, and that you know a deep dive into their sexual and gender identities might not even need to be the first thing out of your mouth when you befriend them.
Yeah, I like the way you phrase that because I find that people who want to be respectful are really scared of making mistakes, and they're just overly careful, and that causes them stress. And so I often try to prod them along and say, it's okay, but, like, you know, continue the conversation, come from a good place. And also, I think, like, it's okay for you to read up on these things.
Yeah, also, I mean, I increasingly, and this is not only in my experience as a writer, there is that classic creative writing message, you know, show, don't tell. So, sure, I can tell you about all kinds of identities, and I can explain my journey, to use that word we now overuse too much. But more important is the showing. You know, you want to know about my life, look at me. This is how I live in the world. This is how I am human. And, you know, you may not need to know everything about my chromosomes or what drugs I took or, you know, if I had my nose fixed. Like, you know, I mean, we can get to that. No, and no, this is my nose. I'll have you.
Well, the interview's over. We found out.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would pay to have this nose. But, I mean, who knows? Maybe it's called, you know, the full boiling. So, you know.
I just think that when you, 15 years ago, we were talking about, in 2003, you were on the Oprah show. You were talking in very big outlets. And it was so vital and important for people to see, you know, the word normal is, you know, people have issues with, but if it doesn't offend you, I want to call you normal. You're a professor, you're a wife, you're a mother.
Yeah, well, and in some ways, every once in a while, when I speak to those audiences I was describing earlier, I'll have a group of fairly kind of self-identifying radical people in the front row who I can see kind of going. In fact, one time a group of people, I could hear them sighing audibly as I told my adorable little stories of how we should all love each other and how I was raising my family and I could hear people, you know, especially I think at an earlier stage of my career, I think non-binary people didn't find much use in my kind of in what seemed like embracing a so-called normal identity. Now, I mean, I kind of want to say, well, look, I tell you what, I'm still doing this work almost 20 years later, and in that time I have raised two sons in rural Maine in a conservative town. I've been married now for almost 30 years to the same woman, 12 years as husband and wife, almost 18 years as wife and wife. And I think in some ways there's nothing more radical than raising a family. I mean, depending on how you raise the family. But, going in and doing your work and, it's, again, it's that showing rather than the telling. Now, believe me, as this program makes clear, telling has a place too. But somebody said to me one time, the most important thing I did on that Oprah show, I was on that show a bunch of times, but the first time I was on that show was I sat there in my Ellen Tracy suit and was relatively calm and relatively funny and sudden. Because I think the thing is, people used to think the transgender experience, well, and gay experience for that matter, but certainly transgender experience, was from some far off place, from the planet Jupiter. It is, and if people, including people like my dear friend Kate Bornstein, who identify as outlaws, I love that. I say, be the outlaw that your heart demands that you be. But it's also okay if you have other more important things to do with your life than being trans or gay, or bi 24 hours a day. You know, if you wanna be a parent, if you wanna be a teacher, if you wanna. Run a television show, that's what she should do. And then because we do everything as gay people, we do everything as trans people, and so our identities as queer people is not about how we have sex or what our bodies are shaped. Like, our identities as queer people are about how we breathe the air, how we drink the water, how we laugh from the bottom of our hearts, and cry big fat tears sometimes too. Those are the ways in which we are human. And so when we talk about gay experience, we're not talking about how people have sex. We're talking about every breath you take from the moment you get up to when you go to sleep.
Yeah. I feel deeply obligated to give back the community, to create for the community, to do service work for the community, etc. And I feel that need to give those hours because I think that the harder job is actually what I discussed with my friends, like being in Maine and being like the only one.
Yeah, although as I've learned now, I'm not the only one. So I left Colby. I now teach at Barnard College, which is part of Columbia University in New York City. But I worked at at Colby College in Maine for 25 years, and I love teaching there. And I'm happy to have my new gig. But at a certain point, I got an opportunity to do something else. So now I'm doing something else. But so they replaced me at Colby College. When I left, they hired a new person. They hired a young woman, another English teacher, and they took my my old office. And the summer after I left, the person came out as trans. and now he is like a trans professor at Colby College. I'm like, geez, you think it's something in the air? Is it like the water fountain down the hall? What's the deal? So, there are more and more. I mean, I think there are thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of us across the country, and in little places like Maine and Cheyenne, Wyoming, and Olympia, Washington, where I'll be tomorrow. But what's different is that now people can come out. Now people can be visible and be known. And to a certain extent, that makes it easier. Although I should also, to go over to the dark side, I should also say that with increased visibility also comes increased blowback, increased resistance, and in some cases, increased violence. And increased legislation against us by people who used to give us a pass because they didn't know that they were supposed to hate us, because they didn't know we existed. So now...
Isn't that a necessary hump, though?
Yeah, I guess. Although I kind of like the idea of a necessary hump. Let's just parse that phrase. But, I think... Well, I used to get away with a lot of things because I was just under the radar, Like, I went to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles in Maine and just, told them, oh, would you look at this? They put an M on my driver's license when they should have put an F. And the person behind the window was like, ha ha, oh, that's so funny. Miss Boylan, we'll fix that for you right away. And no one asked to see a birth certificate. No one asked to see, a contract from a lawyer. I was like, ooh, would you look at that funny thing? Okay, we'll fix that. So now there's a whole process. And so now, in fact, I couldn't do that. Now there are rules. I mean, the rules aren't, at least in Maine, aren't too bad. But it is a necessary process. I'm sorry that the blowback generally doesn't fall upon me and on, white ladies of privilege from New England. The blowback falls upon people of color and women of color in particular in the transgender community. Not only, but particularly people who are doing sex work. Some people who want to do sex work and other people who have to, because that's kind of the only way to keep the lights on while you're trying to figure out what to do with your life and how to get from where you are to where you want to be. And it costs a lot of people their lives. So that's another thing that's changed from 2003 is that I would never speak for someone else, but I try to honor the experience of people who aren't me, and particularly to shout out to people who are really at risk. I mean, in this new world that we're in, we're all at risk. But transgender women of color are at particular risk, and we need to change that. So to the extent that I can be a positive force for that, both as a person who's visible, as a person who is trying to lead GLAAD and other LGBT nonprofits to help educate people in this country so that people can live their lives without fear and they can know that the law protects them too.
Yeah, And with your visibility you mentioned, was that your plan all along?
My plan.
Your secret plan, like open the plan.
No, my plan was to do one memoir, to do She's Not There, and then to go back to writing novels. Because I figured... I used to say to people, you know, I'm not an activist, you know, I'm just an English teacher. And what I've, I mean, sometimes I even still say that, but what I've learned is that English teacher means activist, or that, excuse me, that to be, that there are a lot of different ways of being an activist, and one of them is by telling stories. That's the thing that brought me to GLAAD in particular, because GLAAD does not do legislation, GLAAD does not do policy. GLAAD works through the media. GLAAD accelerates acceptance by trying to make sure that our stories are told properly in film, on TV, in print, in the digital space. And so as a storyteller, I thought, okay, there's a place I could do something good. I've been part of GLAAD for 7 years now. I'm in my final year on that board. And things have changed at GLAAD, too. Not only in terms of the work we do, which is increasingly focused on transgender work. It's about, last time I checked, it was about 40% of our work was in terms of trans advocacy. But
that's a big change for them as well.
It's less of a change than you'd think, because we were always doing this work. Our longest-serving employee is Nick Adams, who is a trans guy here in L.A., who is now the, you know, the director of our transgender media desk. But I think we're more visible about the work we're doing. We're more we put it front and center now, and I've also tried to transify the board, and to some extent the staff, although I don't hire the staff, but our board of 25 people is, I think, 5 or 6 transgender people right now. Including, there's an orange farmer from Florida now on the board, a trans guy. I was the first transgender guy, and when I introduced him at the at his first board meeting, I said, well, finally, GLAAD has a demographic on the board I've long been hoping to include, and by that, of course, I mean farmers. So anyway, yeah, GLAAD's doing good work. I'm really proud of them. They're growing and growing. We're about to launch a new project called the GLAAD Institute, which will be, which will train people, and well, it'll be an educational institute, but it'll specifically train people to do the work that we do, so that so you don't need GLAAD to do the work. You can have GLAAD show you how to do the work, and you can do that in your hometown. So all that's ahead.
Huge. And this is your last year as the co-chair of the board. Will you stay on the board, though?
I have to term off in early next year. But I'll always be part of GLAAD. I might be part of the Institute as well. I might be teaching there.
Great.
So we'll see.
I asked about your visibility, and as if it was a choice earlier, because for a lot of people in America, you were the first person they saw who was transgender on TV when it wasn't sensational. You know, it wasn't on Jerry Springer. And I was thinking back to Rosa Parks, and she... this makes sense, I promise.
But no, also, well, if you're comparing me to her, I'm a little... flabbergasted.
To her story, because when I learned of Rosa Parks, she was this cute older lady that was sitting on the bus, and she just really wanted to sit down in the front. And then only later, I don't know if I missed this in school, did I find out that this was part of the plan all along, and she was actually like the second person, but the first one, you know, we don't, is not as famous, and this was part of the movement to have this woman, and we elected Rosa Parks to be the one to do that. And you were making a lot of rounds. She's Not There was the first book by a trans author in the country to hit the New York Times bestsellers list. I didn't know if that was a choice to make it Jennifer Finney Boylan, or if it was an accident.
It was an accident. The publisher, in fact, I don't think really knew what was going to happen with this book. It was certainly not the book that Random House expected to be a bestseller. I will say that being on the Oprah Winfrey Show helped a lot. The fact that halfway through the show, Oprah decided to make it 2 shows, that helped a lot. It helps a little bit that I'm an English teacher, and I know how to teach a class. I mean, I'm far from the perfect model for our people. But I do know, you know, if everything goes just so, I think I can teach a pretty good class. So I just, you know, whenever I get nervous about that role, I just pretend I'm teaching a class. But no, it was not a plan. If it were a plan, I would have done it differently. I was surprised that people wanted to hear me keep talking about these issues. Because, I mean, there have been other transgender authors before. Kate Bornstein's work was groundbreaking in the 90s. And there were books by or about other transgender people before. But I think the fact that my book was a book by someone trained as a writer and then it kind of read like a novel, I think that's what brought in all the kind of, you know, Midwestern book club moms. You know, it's She's Not There is not the most radical book you're going to read in the trans canon, but it is, I hope it's one of the books that's written well, and that it was funny. There was a BuzzFeed article a few years ago that had like a list. There was like a listicle of trans memoirs, and the good news is that She's Not There was the number one memoir, but the, I don't know if this is the bad news, but the little tag afterwards said, "This is the book to give your mom." and to the extent that it was not a plan, I can tell you that She's Not There, and a lot of my writing is not aimed primarily at a trans audience or even at a queer audience. It was aimed at, you know, my mother's bridge club. It was aimed at moms who are concerned but who moms who are maybe uncomfortable with talking about LGBTQ issues, at least they were in up until the 90s, but who want to do well by their children and who are moved by the story of someone who seems familiar. Somebody, after I was on that first Oprah show, somebody emailed me and said, in fact, I remember she was from Omaha, Nebraska. I forget her name, but she said, "Jenny Boylan, the weird thing about you is that you seem almost like a person somebody could know."
Almost.
Well, but see, to me, that's an amazing phrase, because that's the thing right there, that I think we used to think of transgender people, I said Jupiter before, wherever it wasn't next door. It wasn't somebody that you could know. Now I'm hoping, not only as a result of my work, but as a work of many people who are now living their lives openly and joyfully, now there's a lot of people that you could know that are trans and who are trans not the way I'm trans, but the way that they're trans, and that all these different ways of being trans are cool.
Yeah, and could you have anticipated or predicted where we were going in terms of trans people and gender non-binary people and gender non-conforming people?
The thing that got my attention, I mean, if I had to kind of tick off the turning points of the last 15 years or 20 years, because I came out almost 20 years ago right now, or I came out to my family anyway. So the marriage equality movement was a big change, and not only because people could get married, which is the obvious thing that movement achieved, but the marriage equality movement also changed the way the country, cis and straight people talk about queer people. And by that I mean this: it used to be that if you asked a bunch of straight people, particularly straight guys, let's say middle-aged white guys, straight white guys,
I don't know any.
if you asked guys like that about gay men, you'd probably get a ha 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 and a little nasty joke about how gay men have sex. So there was a kind of middle school dirty joke approach to talking about queer people if you were a straight person. So the conversation was about sex. The marriage equality movement changed the discourse to a conversation about love. Because if you went to my mother's bridge club and said, "Hey, who here is in favor of butt fucking?" Well, one or two ladies might have raised a hesitant hand, but most of them would have been very embarrassed. If you said, "Who here is in favor of love?" Okay, everybody's hands up. everybody's hands up. Because who's going to be against love? Or if you're going to be against love for gay people, you're going to have to explain why gay people don't deserve love. And then you're going to have to do these kind of contortions. So the marriage equality movement made it possible for the discourse to change from sex to love. And believe me, we need a discourse around sex. I won't do a deep dive there now. So that's the first thing that happened, is that the national conversation around queer lives became more dignified and became more respectful in some ways as a result of talking about love. So that's one thing that happened. I will leave it for others to say what effect She's Not There had on the movement. I know that the book came out right at a moment when the culture was changing. A lot of things were in the air. And Oprah Winfrey, in presenting me for several days as, to use that word, fairly normal-seeming, then youngish middle-aged woman with a family and children and students who appeared to love her, that was a moment also that changed the conversation. Because with transgender people, we didn't used to talk about sex, but we always talked about operations. Tell me about your operation. Have you had the operation? You know, where did you get your operation? Can you have an orgasm? That was the number one question that used to be asked to me every time I'd speak anywhere. Can you have an orgasm? I'm like, yeah, I can have an orgasm. Can you write a book? So there was that. Another key moment for me was when, was it Carmen Carrera and Laverne Cox were on the Katie Couric show, and she asked about, you know, tell me about your operation. And I think it was Carmen, and certainly Laverne, who said, we're not going to go there. We don't do that. That's not what this is about. And I wish that I'd had the courage to do that with Oprah, because Oprah asked me that question, and I was like, you know, yes, I have a vagina. And Oprah began singing to me. Check the tape. She sang, yes, she has a vagina. And I sat there.
Really?
She sang that, yeah. And I said, actually, what you mean to say is, yes, we have no bananas. Ha, ha, ha. So I made a little joke back to her, and I kind of sat there and took it. But, you know, later, I remember I was on the plane going home thinking, that's not cool to say that. But then there was no sense of anybody pushing back, and I didn't, and I guess I was not courageous enough to push back. I was a little intimidated by Oprah, so I didn't do that.
But later
Carmen and Laverne did, and that was a huge moment. And now people know that you have a transgender person on your show or your TV show or whatever, that's not what the conversation is going to be about.
And people had a lot of questions just about the definition of transgender. And so they're navigating that. And that is what I find with non-binary people and gender non-conforming people today. We had Asia Kate Dillon on the show.
Oh.
They're the first non-binary actor on TV.
Yeah.
And we only had them for 25 minutes. And we spent about 20 minutes talking about their gender.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of killed me because it negates their amazing accomplishments.
Yeah.
But it's just where we are today, I feel like, also.
Well, I would say that as much as my heart wraps right around non-binary people, I also have to accept the fact that that's not my identity. And so it's, you know, we should be having non-binary people tell their stories. We don't want... You know, we shouldn't be having Jenny Boylan explain the lives of people whose experience of gender is really different from mine. I'm a fairly binary person in most ways, actually. And that's a good thing too. But I feel like there's just so many ways of being trans. If someone tells me that they want, you know, what their pronouns are or what their name is, like, I'm going to call them their name by that name and those pronouns. And I kind of don't want to know a whole big thing about their theory of gender. Because, I mean, on the one hand, how incredibly cool that we're at a place now where you can say, here's how my experience of the world and my experience of my body and my psyche is going to translate into my human experience before you, and this is the way the language is going to reflect that. Okay, so we can do a whole deep dive. On the other hand, it's boring, and I don't want to know. You want me to call you this name and this pronoun? Great. So now let's talk about the Red Sox, you know, or let's talk about the Grateful Dead. To pick two topics that everyone wants to talk about, you know,
with you. The Grateful Who?
Yeah. Okay. So it's just. You know, I'm on Twitter a lot, of course, and frequently, particularly when I do something that gets me in front of the headlights of the right-wing media, which is more often than you'd think, I get these trolls who start taking me down and who want to say, you know, who say, actually, we should say him with you, or, you know, your name is, and then they'll use my name of 20 years ago.
Are they Googling you to find that out?
I don't know what they're doing, but what I quickly say is, okay, what's your name for the president after Nixon? And they'll be like, well, President Ford. I'm like, well, actually, but Gerald Ford is a name he made up. His birth name was Leslie King, but we all call him Gerald Ford, you know.
That's a fun fact.
So, well, I mean, you know, Harry S. Truman, S doesn't stand for anything. He wanted a middle initial, so he has a middle initial. So we call people, I mean, what's the guy, The Edge in, is it U2?
Oh, yeah.
The Edge. Wasn't the bass player? The Edge.
Yeah.
He has a real name, but we call him The Edge, you know, because that's, you know. So, you know, I'm going to call him The Edge, because I say, what's your name? I'm The Edge. Okay, you're The Edge. Fantastic. You know, I'm going to call.
And that doesn't cause you any stress.
I'm going to call Cher. I don't even know what her last name is, actually, anymore.
I have no idea.
Does it matter?
No.
Roseanne, you know, I'm going to call you your name. So how hard is this to do? I mean, I can give you a whole big, we can have a whole deep dive conversation about non-binary gender, and we need to have that conversation because it's great, because it's a thing we should celebrate. But you know what? We should get out of the business of defending ourselves and explaining ourselves. If people say, and this is the thing that happens to me all the time now, about every 6 weeks, the Times or the Post or the Times of London, or maybe on the Bill Maher show, there's some person who comes out, Milo, what's his name, come out and they had this thing about how transgender people aren't who they say they are, or I think transgender children deserve to be laughed at, ha ha ha, and people will ask me to provide the defense, to provide the counter, and I'm now like, you know what, my counter is, look at me, look at my life. This, you want to know how I refute you? I refute you by living every day according to what's in my heart and according to the stars by which I pilot my boat. And I'm not here to have an argument about my own humanity. I'm not here to even participate in an argument about my humanity, which I might actually win or lose, right? I mean, I'm happy to talk about all this stuff, obviously. It's interesting, but nobody should have to take part in a conversation in which their sense of self is something that they have to defend.
Right,
and that's whether you're non-binary or binary or mortal or immortal. People should get to be themselves. Period.
Yes, I want to go back for a second. You said something really interesting that in terms of the gay and lesbian movement, it really ramped up when we rebranded and talked about love, marketing.
Mm.
Right now, in terms of the trans movement, we can argue if that's happening or not. The trans movement, gender identity isn't sexy in terms of marketing.
Yeah, I wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Times a couple years ago in which I was trying to say we should be kind of getting behind identity as as the bridge, in fact, because on the surface of it, identity, someone not feeling at home in their body, someone not being who they are, this is a thing that people who are cis or straight supposedly struggle with. Like, really, you were born in that body, but you felt like, I mean, I can't imagine what that's like. And because people can't imagine it, they assume it must not exist. So, the thing is, though, Everybody knows what it's like not quite to be yourself, to have something that stands between you and the person you hope to become. And whether it's a fear you have to conquer, or a test you have to pass, or a way of seeing the world or being in the world that's different from where you are now, I think the experience of not quite being yourself, of not having an authentic identity, is universal, or nearly universal. And the only people who don't suffer from this are people who have never examined their own lives. I mean, I know there are such people, but...
Do you think that identity is the word?
I don't... It doesn't sound... You said sexy. It doesn't...
Yeah.
Do you have a word?
I don't. I'm seeking it out, though.
Me too.
I will call you when I find it.
Well,
but I mean that very seriously.
Because we talked about love. I mean, that's all it took.
Yeah.
To suddenly, for people to open their hearts. And so, you can say, be yourself. Being. Human being. Being human. We need, I mean, it's...
I kind of like that.
How hard is it to understand that we're all trying to become ourselves? And if you don't understand how somebody else is struggling to become themselves, just open your heart. You don't need to know, like I said before, you don't need to know the difference between intersex and gender nonconforming.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nice if you do, but if you don't, just open your heart. Be nice.
And I think that...
Just be nice.
Just be nice. I think that, like, it's going to have to be as simple as, I just want to be myself. You know? I just think that many people in America hear the term gender identity, and they're like, that means nothing to me.
Yeah, or they're like, uh-oh, they're coming for my guns. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't think we're going to solve that issue now, but let me know when you decide, because I think you're going to get there faster than I will.
Well, this is an important conversation we're having, actually, because... so much depends on this, and it's a thing I write about in Long Black Veil, the new novel. It's a thing I wrote about I had a piece in the Times last summer. A concept that the philosopher Edmund Burke, I promise you this is not boring, the philosopher Edmund Burke,
I haven't been bored yet,
called moral imagination. Moral imagination means the ability to imagine the life of somebody who is not you. So, and I experienced this last year when in one day, as a result of an accident, I lost about 3/4 of my hearing. Like, one day, a thing happened. In fact, the fire alarm in my apartment went off really close to my ears, and when it was off, I was 3/4 deaf. And so since that time, I've been struggling to adapt to a very changed way of being in the world. And it used to be... It wasn't that I didn't understand that people are deaf. And it wasn't that my heart didn't go out to people who are deaf, but now that I am 3/4 one of them, it's a very different experience. But you shouldn't have to lose your hearing to have compassion for people who are deaf. You shouldn't have to be trans or to have a child who's trans in order to have compassion for someone who's trans. You shouldn't have to be black or Asian or white, for that matter, in order to have compassion for somebody who is not you. So how do we compel people to imagine the lives of others? Anyway, like I said, that's that particular complaint and prayer is all over Long Black Veil, the new novel.
It is. I really liked it. It's a thriller, but it's also very funny, I have to say.
Oh, I'm glad you think so.
Your wit is all over it.
I am sneaky that way.
Yeah, it's also Lord of the Rings.
Oh my God. there's a thing toward the end where the character, there is a trans character, I don't want to give too much away, there is a trans character, one of the six major characters whom we meet as 22-year-olds at the beginning of the book, later as a middle-aged woman, long past transition, she's thinking about what's happened in the movement, and obviously she's not too far from me, and she's looking back over the last 20 years, kind of in the way that you and I have been, and thinking about how things have changed, and she's saying that she knows that the world has gotten to be a safer place for transgender people, or for some transgender people anyhow, but she said, but I was never that brave. She says, I set out to save the Shire, and the Shire has been saved, but not for me. And whenever I read that piece, without any warning, tears just roll down my face. I don't know why. Maybe it's just I've got a Frodo thing going on.
Yeah.
Or Elijah Wood. Or maybe it's because I feel a little bit like, if I do identify with that, I've never really talked about this before. I guess in some ways, I mean, I was glad to be able to be a person who helped change the culture and bring us to this place. But in another way, I feel like, how cool would it be to be in the next generation, to be in the generation where things are not quite so hard, where when you came out, you didn't have to explain everything, like you just invented the whole thing yourself. So when I say the Shire has been saved, but not for me, and there might be a little creeping self-pity, which is perhaps uncalled for, because really, I am one of the luckiest people that I know. And not only because of what I've been able to do as a writer and within the movement, but also because, you know, I've been married for 30 years and I have two incredibly cool children. I have to tell you a story about one of my sons. I'm afraid the show is going to go. We're going to go into extra hours. But here's the thing that happened today. I'm waiting in line to board the plane to Los Angeles, and the phone rings. And I'm like, what? And it's my son, Zach. He's 23. He's like, I can't get into the mailbox. I'm like, and he's in my apartment in New York City. He's staying there this week while I do this. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's because I've got the key. Because I've got the keys. He's like, well, I need to get into the mailbox. I'm like, well, why? Well, because the stuff I ordered came. What's the stuff you ordered? You know, all the hot peppers and the hot sauce and he's got this bet going on with a friend of his where successively each of them is eating hotter and hotter things and making a YouTube vid of it and posting it and then challenging the next one to beat that and top it. So he's got like 10 million BTU Scotch bell peppers and flaming hot sauce and pepper from Yugoslavia, and he's gonna that's his plan, you know. And I'm like, well, you're gonna have to wait till I come home. And he's like, but I planned my whole day around this. So now I'm having this kind of this fight with him in the line to board the plane as he's saying, Can we call security to open the mail? I was like, well, I don't think security can open mailboxes. You'd have to ask the post office, and that's, you're not really the legal resident of it. And he's like, well, and so he's mad at me somehow for preventing him from being able to make the video of him eating the hot sauce. And that, my friend, is what it means to be transgender.
you had one line, that's really funny. You had one line in the book, though, that it was so small, but it just kind of gutted me because it said something along the lines of, I just want to call everybody I've ever met and say I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah, I had that feeling early on. There's a way of, and I don't know if young queer people feel that way now.
Oh, really? Because I would have countered with saying that's nothing about being trans. That's about being a human.
Yeah.
I don't want to take this out of your court.
Jeff, I think you're right. I think that there is just a sense of,
I remember
late in his life, someone asked Jerry Garcia, was there anything you regret in his life? And he said something like, yeah, well, not really, except I just wish it all could have been a whole lot more fun. And I guess I feel that way sometimes. But I do, it's a heavy burden, the feeling that you've let people down, the feeling that somehow you weren't what they expected. That, you know, if I've complicated anyone's life, I'm thinking of my mother, my sister, my wife, and to some degree my children and my friends. Okay, well, everybody. If I've complicated people's lives, I don't know. I'm just enough of a sentimentalist to feel sorry why should I be sorry? You know, I mean, should I be any sorrier for that than for the fact that I'm three quarters deaf? Should I be sorrier that for that than the fact that I had, you know, cataracts or that I lost a tooth? You know, should I mean, this is what it means to be human.
And I think it stops you probably from telling everybody I'm sorry is the fact that nobody's knocking on your door just to be like, hey, Jenny, by the way, I'm really sorry. And you're like, oh, for what? I forgot about that. And they're like, I've been thinking about it for years.
Have you ever had anyone do that?
Never. It struck me, though, because I feel like every day I wake up and I think, this is who Jeff is. This is who I am. I know exactly who I am. And then I just have to wait 6 months. And I'm like, oh, my God, who was that guy?
Oh, old Jeff. Oh, right. Younger
he
Jeff.
He knew nothing.
Past Jeff.
I'm so wise now and smart. And I just feel like a completely different person every 6 months.
Well, this is one of the weird things about having come out as trans at about age 40. So, I'm just shy of 60 now. So I've had these three phases in my life, really, of 20 years each. I have 20 years of being a child and an adolescent, 20 years of being a youngish man, and then 20 years as a woman. And 20 years is long ago enough now that I can look at pictures of myself as a younger woman and think, I'm not that woman anymore. In fact, I've been maybe three or four different women at this point in my life. You know, early on in transition, I was very youthful. I was very, I cared a lot about my appearance and being sexy and my clothes. Fashion was really important to me. Passing was really important to me. Appearing cis, I'm sorry to say, was probably more important to me than it should have been. And then, you know, then I was like a soccer mom, you know. And I don't know what I am now. I'm like an older stateswoman, maybe. I don't know. But, you know, I'm at the point in my life now where I have a closet that has clothes in it that I haven't worn in a long time, and I look at those clothes and I'm like, oh my God, I bought that when I was in my, you know, my L.L. Bean phase, you know, oh, how embarrassing, you know, or I bought that when I was doing the J. Jill thing. Oh, I'm so glad that's over. And when you go through transition, like when you first have, for me, when I had clothes in my closet that I wanted, it was such a huge thing. I couldn't believe, oh my God, there's dresses. Look at these dresses. Look at all the dresses. Well, I don't wear dresses anymore, actually, because, I mean, except, you know, like graduation or something, because, you know, I don't know, they're cold or something. Maybe if I lived in California, I'd wear more dresses, but, you know, I just so the thing that at one time in my life was the symbol of all that I had dreamed and hoped for and had been kept away from me has now become, oh, that old thing. I should give that away. So it's the spectacular mystery of life is the way we keep becoming other versions of ourselves. And in fact, maybe that's the way, getting back to this question of identity, maybe that's the thing. We still didn't have the language for it, but this experience of, you know, I had these clothes in my closet, and then I had these clothes, and I had these clothes. That's the thing. I think it's universal. I remember my sister used to be like all in whenever she'd do a thing. So she was a deadhead in the 70s. Then she went totally punk in the late 70s. Then she was like kind of country western in the 80s. Then she moved to England, and then she was like a kind of an English country, you know, housewife for a while. And then she was a mom, you know, and then she became an academic. And so I always imagine her closet as having, you know, it's like archaeological layers. The farther back you go, the younger version of herself you could find. And that's probably true of everybody, right? Tell me you don't have something that you never wear, but you'll never part with it because that's old Jeff.
Absolutely. And I've started the cycle where I started buying things that I would have worn like 12 years ago, but it's in like a bigger size.
Oh, that's very sneaky.
My last purchase, that's my favorite thing about all year, is that for the last 2 years I've wanted short overalls that are shorts. Just denim overalls, and I finally bought them.
Like overalls, like
over yeah, legit overalls.
But they're short.
Well, I bought capri, so I cut them into shorts, and then I rolled them. And they're my favorite thing ever.
I like
and
the way you think.
They make me laugh so much, and I love wearing them.
You know what makes me laugh? Of course, and this you have to be a person who lives in northern New England for this, but a union suit. Like a which I have, which is bright red, and it does have like buttons on the trapdoor for going to the bathroom in the middle of the night. And when I was on the Caitlyn Jenner show, my closest friend on that show was Candace Kane, who is just the most gorgeous woman and always has the most gorgeous clothes. And I really wanted to bring the union suit one night and just kind of come out of the bathroom and say, "Oh, hiya, Candace, how are ya?" But I didn't do it because I was afraid, you know. Because for one thing, we know we were in California and it was not really cold enough to justify. But I can tell you that I love that union suit. Oh my God.
That's so funny.
I think those things are going to come back in style.
And you're ready. You're ready.
People should wear them on the street. Now, what's this thing about the jumper?
Oh, the male jumper.
That was all over Twitter yesterday.
I'm not mad at it.
What is the story?
It's just they. I don't know enough to tell it. Talk about
if we go
it,
there, is that the
shorts
rest of
with
the
a jumper? Yeah, that's section. Yeah. That's podcast two.
Okay, all right.
It's like over. We're gonna split it too. But it's just I'm not mad at it. Is all I'm gonna say. That okay. It exists and that people want to wear it. I think good. It's fantastic.
All right.
Maybe yeah. I'll buy one.
Ten years from now.
I can't do it. Yeah, 10 years from now. I have to let you go. This was so much fun, though. Thank you very much.
I'm delighted to have been here. Thanks.
Absolutely. If people want to buy the book, it's called Long Black Veil. It's out now. Also, if they want to find you, so you send them to your website, your Twitter.
Yeah, well, let's send everybody to jenniferboylan.net. That's the website. Also, the Twitter handle, Jenny Boylan.
Fantastic.
And all over Facebook as well.
Fantastic. And I'm on Twitter at JeffMasters1. You can also find all of our interviews on YouTube and iTunes. And if you really want to help us out, tell everyone you know or just 5 friends. And if you don't have 5 friends, and you have like 5 enemies, tell them. It'll really screw them over. All right. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.